Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. I happened upon a book recently entitled The Life of Hinduism, and I wanted to share some of its contents today. It brings together a series of essays, many recognized as classics in the field, that present Hinduism as a vibrant, truly lived religion. Celebrating the diversity for which Hinduism is known, this volume begins its journey in the New India of Bangalore, India's Silicon Valley, where global connections and local traditions rub shoulders daily. Readers are then offered a glimpse into the multifaceted world of Hindu worship, life cycle rites, festivals, performances, gurus, and castes. The book's final sections deal with the Hinduism that is emerging in the diasporic North America and with issues of identity that face Hindus in India and around the world, militancy versus tolerance, and the struggle between owning one's own religion and sharing it with others. Today we have both co-editors with us today on Common Threads, John Stratton Hawley and Vasudha Narayan. Let me tell you a little bit about both of them. John Stratton Hawley is a Clare Tau Professor of Religion at Barnard College at Columbia University. Jack Hawley has directed Columbia University's South Asia Institute and has received multiple awards from NEH, the Smithsonian, and the AIIS. He's been a Guggenheim Fellow and was recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 2016 and 17, he's been in India as a Fulbright Nehru Fellow, working on a project called the New Brindavan. Vasudha Narayan is a distinguished professor, the Department of Religion at the University of Florida, and past president of the American Academy of Religion. She was educated at the universities of Madras and Bombay in India and Harvard University here. Her fields of interest are the Hindu traditions in India, Cambodia, and America, visual and expressive cultures in the study of Hindu traditions, and gender issues. She is currently working on Hindu temples and traditions in Cambodia. So we welcome to Common Threads both John Hawley and Vasudha Narayan. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you indeed, Fred.
Certainly. So my first question to you is this. When we talk about the life of Hinduism as a lived religion, I know that it's interesting that whenever people, say, criticize a religion or have any sort of questions for it, oftentimes people will immediately go to their scriptures, go to their tradition, and they'll say, no, you have this wrong. We're not this way or that way. For instance, if you were to criticize Islam because of all of the terrorism that is there, people will go to the Quran and they'll say, no, you've got this wrong. Look what it says in the Quran. So we might look what it says in the Quran, and the Quran might say something completely the opposite of what terrorists are saying. But at the same time, we still have this issue with terrorism in Islam. So we have the lived religion and we have the ideal religion. And certainly no religion over 6 weeks old is invulnerable from this, that there are always the ideals and there is the lived religion. In this book, would you say that this the idea of a lived religion, as opposed to and in conjunction with the ideals, is that what is expressed in the book?
You go first, Vasu.
I would say we certainly try to get the lived religion balance into a field which has been textually dominated. In fact, one of my early encounters with the study of Hinduism in this country, in America, was that it was so textually dominated that I couldn't understand and recognize the way, say, my grandmother had practiced it. So when you speak about the ideal religion, I would argue that most communities most friends, most families I know of in India would say that they, the way they live their lives is in a way trying to get to the ideal religion. Why? Because while texts are plenty and very, very important in India, in Hinduism, I would say that custom and practice are equally important. And in fact, has been recognized that way. Even the Supreme Court of India has recognized it. And so while the text may say something, the practice may be a little different, but practice and the custom and practice usually trumps it and has been, and it has been that way, I would argue, for centuries within the Indian subcontinent.
Oh, certainly.
More than centuries, actually, if I can just jump in.
Sure.
There are a couple of passages in the ancient Griha Sutras, the scriptures, so to speak, that have to do with rites that bear on household living, where explicit deference is made to women as interpreters of the tradition. And the texts themselves, which surely were written down by men, point to women as the carriers of the tradition as it's actually lived. So there's a sort of issue of interpretation that arises, a way of referring to actual practice at that point in time was to talk, to invite a conversation with the women who actually were knew more about how the faith, so to speak, should be practiced at that point in time than perhaps the very men who were writing those texts.
Oh.
One of the things that started us into this project was the, as Vasu was saying, the fact that she could come to Harvard and not recognize the tradition, you know, that she came from or that her grandmother came from in relation to what was being said in books. We wanted to do a book that would be very different from that. Yes, it would still be a text, and it would still be used as a book in classrooms, but our hope was that it would shine a light on what really happens in the practice of the tradition itself, rather than repeating, pre-digested notions of what a religion ought to be like.
How did you go about in choosing the authors that would be a part of the book?
I think both of us went to articles that we had really loved, really been interested in, things which had intrigued us, things which had hit us in some way, either positively or in some way made us think through an issue, and then went to a representative subset of them. We wanted to be sure that many of the themes that are very important in the practice of the Hindu culture were represented. Not all of them are there by any means, but say gender, issues of caste, performance. Most of us understand text through the transmission done through singing, through music, through plays, the Ram Leela, and now through television. So to get a sense of this to a classroom was important, just so they don't, a student sitting in an undergraduate freshman class here wouldn't think that the transmission takes place on a Sunday morning through a sermon in India or here. So I think that part of it was very important for us. I think if we were to do this all over again, there would be other themes that we will be likely to introduce also. But a short story by Lalita Ambikantar Janam, for instance, was mind-blowing to me when I read it first. She herself had come from a high-caste Brahmin family, had somewhat Marxist views, I think, but had been a freedom fighter and had spoken about how in one area, in one community, despite in Kerala, which is known for its the importance it gives to women and its matrilineal, even there, women are subjugated, I would say, and very much under the control of men if they belong to a particular caste. But the other castes, while the women had a freedom and a certain sense of leadership, women of the Brahmin caste did not have it. At least this was about 100 years ago. And we wanted this to be represented. But we were also mindful about a time period. And I think, Jack, bear me out on this, we tried to keep materials to within the last 100 years or so, would you think?
Well, actually, since you've opened the door to that, Fasu, if we look at that section of the book, which is called Caste, and let me say parenthetically that the very issue of using the word caste in relation to Hindu traditions is a live issue for Hindus living in the United States today. Should the term caste have been used? Maybe we can just set that aside for the moment because we have some kind of idea of what it refers to, and your story brings it to life. We rarely have more than two essays in a given section. And in the caste section of the book, that's also true. So we have this wonderful essay from Kerala, from a woman born into a Brahmin family in Kerala. And then we had to think, okay, if we're going to start there, what can we pair it with? And what we chose for that was the poet saint, the Dalit poet saint, Ravidas, who lived in Banaras in the course of the 16th century, but is still revered and worshipped today. So while it's true that the last 100 years are, in a way, our main point of reference, because this is a book about lived Hinduism, after all, it's also true that life as lived brings to light people who have been active in the tradition before.
Oh, absolutely. So,
And actually, it's a complicated, you know, the inclusion of Ravidas as coming from one of the birth groups, one of the caste groups, which has traditionally been kept at arm's length by people who consider themselves to be upper caste. We definitely wanted to make a place for including a figure like Ravidas.
So, since we've opened the door into caste, let's develop this a little bit further. Now, I understand it is a very complicated issue, and I've spoken to a number of Hindus here in the United States and in India as well. And one thing that many of them dislike is even the word caste. They prefer varna and jati. So could we define those and perhaps get an opinion one way or the other with both of you in terms of should the word caste be used, and is it equivalent to varna and jat?
Go ahead, Jack.
Okay.
On the terminology, and then I'll come in with...
Correct me, is what you're going to say. Well, okay, so the word caste is certainly a European word, and it certainly serves as a coverall, or a sort of meeting ground for the two words that you brought before into our conversation, Fred, namely varna and jati. Varna might often be, it does have to do with classification, by the way, so if we're thinking of class, there's a natural analog there. Classification, but it also has associations with color, which then are their evaluative senses, you know, whose color is better than somebody else's. So that's varna. And the other one is jati, which really describes a birth group. It was really the Portuguese coming into the Indian subcontinent with the word casta, put these two things together in what then clearly was a European frame. So there certainly is a reason for resisting it on those grounds. The question is, it seems to me, what you would really substitute it with. Now, you could say, really, it should not be two terms. These are quite distinct concepts, and there's something important there. Varna, as a sort of term for classification per se, is really an ideal category. So if we speak of the four castes, the four varnas, we're talking about something that exists in someone's mental textbook and not very much on the ground.
Exactly.
Whereas if we talk about jati, we're talking about how you're born, and that has to do with who you eat with and who you might marry according to what your relatives might think. Notions, by the way, that are not just Hindu notions, but that carry right straight over into many other aspects of, let us say, American society. Your parents actually care who you're going to be married to. But one can see what different things there are. It's sort of practiced in the one hand and ideal in the other. One of the things that the Portuguese concept of caste did, casta did, and then came to be carried over into English, was to force these two into a relationship, a more stable relationship than they might have had in any particular place in India. And that that one really should ask questions about. So one of the things we hope in working with this book with students is that those kinds of questions will emerge around categories that are well known to the people who walk into our classrooms. Whether they agree with those categories or not, they provide a place to, how to say, to have a discussion that really relates to the way in which people are talking about the Hindu tradition today. What would you say about that, Vasu?
That's correct. I would also say that it doesn't. We can find analogs with every other culture in terms of hierarchies, social hierarchies, but more specifically and closer to home within the Indian subcontinent, you find the caste system, if we want to call it that, in, say, Christianity, in South Indian Christianity. One only has to look at the internet ad sites for weddings, for marriages. And, you know, anyone who's familiar with Indian newspapers will know that the marriage section is larger than the real estate section.
I've seen that, yes.
And sometimes people may not even know the difference the way they're advertised. But say you take the section on Christianity in the newspaper, and you'll say Brahmin Goanese Catholic. Sikhs, another Brahmin, you know, bride, whatever, or Nada. And the question also is, sometimes we can make a distinction between caste and community, and the community would relate to which god or goddess you worship, or sometimes we say a community could be the same as a caste. So it's, as Fred said, it's quite complicated. And delightfully absent in some parts of the diaspora. So we can use a word like caste or jati, and many of the children who have grown up and who have been raised in America may not quite understand what it implies.
Right.
So if you're just joining us,
it's more of a South Asian phenomena, and one that has been complicated or diluted in urban areas quite a bit, has constantly been interrogated by the bhakti movement, by devotion. And so caste becomes a very tragic reality on one end and a paradox on the other when people are not aware of it at all.
Let me just jump in and remind people that you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and today we're talking about the book The Life of Hinduism with its co-editors, John Stratton Hawley and Vasudha Narayan. It is interesting to observe all of this, and it is somewhat overwhelming. And what you say about it affecting other religions and communities in South Asia is certainly true. I saw a movie, a documentary recently, and the name is escaping me. Maybe you've seen it. It was about honor killing in Pakistan, and a woman was shot by her father. He thought he'd killed her, but he hadn't. She survived, and the reason he shot her is because she married someone of a lower caste. They didn't use the word caste. They were Muslim, but it was very clear when the father was interviewed, who was jailed for the attempted murder of his daughter, what he was describing was his daughter marrying beneath her caste, thus bringing dishonor upon their family. So a lot of people don't realize that. I also remember, we talked about the Christians, I remember several years ago, a church was about to have midnight mass, and some people of the lower caste, it was a upper caste church, and they wanted to go to midnight mass, the lower caste, and there was almost a riot there on Christmas Eve. It's astounding and sad at the same time. How do you see, specifically, let me ask you, Vasu, at least right up front, how do you see Americans of Indian origin who are Hindus, how do you see them talking about these issues? Do they acknowledge that this still is a practice here in the United States, or do they think it's something that is just in India?
Well, Vasu, you just spoke to that.
Yes, I think it's a wide spectrum here as anywhere else. I think Hindus born in America are not very aware of caste, particularly in the smaller towns.
I'm sorry. Let me break in. I'm sorry. I really was talking about first generation Indian Americans.
You're talking more about the first generation, not the second generation.
Right. I'm curious how you see them as they react.
Again,
to
it depends on the which town you live in and where you come from. To a large extent, I think we do not pay attention to caste, and in fact, we may not know what caste a particular person is from, except through the names sometimes, and sometimes through the dialect. Frequently, we simply don't know, and we can't ask, and we don't ask. So in the smaller towns, we're such a minority anyway that, any live body who is from the subcontinent, pretty much we get together with them. Now, it may be a different story in the larger areas where there are congregations of large numbers of Hindus, for instance, in New Jersey, where I do see a particular emphasis is on the ritual performances. For instance, in many temples, the worship of the icon, the main murti, or the deity enshrined in the temple is done by male Brahmins in South Indian temples. That still sticks. I think that's still very much in practice, along with the practice of male Brahmins reciting specific prayers. And as Jack said, some of the figures from the past who are so live and vibrant in our tradition, the Bhakti poets, their poems are very much recited in South Indian temples. Andal, a woman poet who lived around the 9th century CE, we can hear her voice, and we can hear her voices not just by the male Brahmins in the temples, but by many women who know her poems, who learn it from childhood, and you can sit there and recite it in any temple, and it doesn't matter which caste they're from. So while it's very important on some level and in a tragic way at times, I would also like to say that it is to deflect the conversation off those the primacy of caste defining Hinduism, especially in the global manifestations. Second, I would argue that people who take on Hindu practices, Hindu ways of belief, but who may be born as Euro-Americans, I don't think they would have a notion of caste, and frequently do not. But rather, there are other aspects of the Hindu traditions, which many of us love, which appeals to them, sometimes the meditational practices, sometimes the prayers, sometimes the text, the beauty of the cosmos as presented in the Upanishads, and so on.
No, agreed, certainly. Speaking of Westerners interested in Hinduism, John, we just have a few minutes left, but if you can, in a couple of minutes, let us know how you got to be a scholar in this field.
Oh, well, I met people like Vasu, and that was the end for me. Is there any other entry to the tradition?
and don't tell me, somebody invited you to dinner.
It could have been, but it actually wasn't in my case. So, by the way, no, you're being very sort of generous in calling me John. People do call me Jack. So, if okay. someone calls me on the phone and you know John, hello or hi John, then I know that they're trying to sell me something, and I just hang up. So, I really am Jack. Although it's confusing because there is another Jack Hawley, and that's what you're trying to avoid. But let's just establish I too am Jack.
Okay.
How did I get into this? Oh my gosh, it wasn't through caste. I wanted to second what Vasu was saying, that we sort of backed into a discussion of caste. As it happened, the figure whom she brought first to our attention, Lalitambika Antarjaman from Kerala, happens to come into the book in a setting where caste is an issue. But that's only one of the things that we talk about in this book, and it's actually not up front. It's too bad that the stereotypization of Indian religion, of Hindu religion in the United States and earlier than that, has been through the institution of caste. In a way, it has something to do with our perception of ourselves as being egalitarians. Now, those Hindus, they are people who, you know, pay attention to hierarchy instead, birth and so forth. Birth doesn't matter in the United States. Oh, really? I don't think so. I live in a caste-ridden city called New York. I love the place. But really, there are huge differences of background and persuasion here. So caste may be a sort of useful lens to think about realities of other societies and other religious traditions, and to force us to look at the relationship between societies and religions in a way that we may be uncomfortable doing as natural-born Americans.
Certainly, I understand.
How did I get into Hinduism? Oh, my gosh. It's a long story, a really long story. But...
tell me, Jack. I haven't heard
that. We don't have time for it right now, as a matter of fact. But there's always next week, and this is a fascinating conversation.
Okay.
I want to make sure you folks come back next week, and we will continue this.
See you next week, Vasu.
See you then. Bye. Thanks, Fred.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Jack Stratton Hawley and Vasudha Narayan talking about the book they co-edited, The Life of Hinduism. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.